This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogaeve in for Terry Gross. There's a new special edition DVD of the film The Right Stuff, based on the book by Tom Wolfe. Today we hear from three pioneers of the space program featured in the film, Alan Shepard, Chris Kraft, and Chuck Yeager. In his book, Wolfe calls General Chuck Yeager the most righteous of all the possessors of The Right Stuff. Yeager was a fighter pilot in World War II and was shot down in France, evaded capture, and returned to the air. After surviving many dogfights, he took another risky job, testing high-performance aircraft. He rapidly gained the reputation of America's top test pilot. And he was the first pilot to fly faster than the speed of sound on October 14, 1947. Here's a scene from the film The Right Stuff. Sam Shepard plays Chuck Yeager.
Say there, Yeager.
Sir?
We were just talking to Slick here about the sound barrier.
Is that right?
And we feel that the X-1 is ready to have a go at it.
We think the X-1's got the answer to go beyond Mach 1.
If there is any beyond. So what do you think, Yager?
Well, I'll tell you what, half these engineers never been off the ground, you know. I mean, they're liable to tell you that the sound barrier is a brick wall in the sky. It'll rip your ears off if you try to go through it. If you ask me, I don't believe the damn thing even exists.
Waitress, a drink from Mr. Yager here.
No, thanks, I got one.
So, do you think you want to have a go at it?
I might.
But since, as you say, this sound barrier doesn't really exist,
How much you got? I'm just joking. The Air Force is paying me already. Ain't that right, sir?
Well, sure, Yager, but...
So when do we go?
Well, how about tomorrow morning?
I'll be there.
When Terry spoke with Chuck Yager in 1988, she asked him whether he knew what the sound barrier was when he took on the assignment of trying to break it.
Sure, I knew the laws of nature, that sound travels at some 760 miles an hour at sea level and some 660 miles an hour at 35,000 feet and higher. I also knew we had buffeting problems because of shock waves, because I experienced those in air combat, you know, in World War II when I was flying Mustangs over Germany. I also experienced it in the early jets, the P-80s and P-84s. I knew exactly what the problem was.
So what image did you have in your mind about breaking the sound barrier? For civilians like us, you almost see this invisible shield or a wall that somebody will be penetrating as they break it.
Yeah, I didn't, give any thought to you, to tell you the truth, Terry, because I was pretty well duty-oriented at that time. I'd been in a war where, a lot of guys get killed, but I'd learned to discipline myself to concentrate on what you're doing and forget about the outcome, because you can't do an awful lot about it anyway. So when we started the X-1 program, I had no idea what I would run into, but the point is I could care less, to tell you the truth. I just had to press on with my mission. So
the plane that you broke the sound barrier in, the X-1, had a nose cone that was designed like a bullet. How come?
Yeah, because they knew that bullets flew faster than sound, and the ogive, or shape of the fuselage of the X-1, was shaped like a 50-caliber bullet. And that's just common sense, because, like I say, we were flying in the area of unknowns.
Was it comfortable where you'd have to sit in
Well, no, it was very uncomfortable, and the reason was we had no source of power in the X-1. We used compressed nitrogen gas to do all the work, like raise and lower the gear and pressurize the liquid oxygen tanks, which, incidentally, they had no seat in the X-1. You sat with your back against the bulkhead, which contained the liquid oxygen, and the temperature of the liquid oxygen was 290 degrees below zero, and it was one of the coldest cockpits I've ever been in my life. And you sat on the floor, and your knees were higher than your rear end, so you could pull high G's without blacking out. And you couldn't see too well out of it, but you got to remember, it was a research airplane, and it was built in 1944. So.
Well, when you were flying it, what indications would you have? What kind of meters would tell you when you had actually broken the sound barrier?
Well, I had an altimeter that told me how high I was. I had an indicated airspeed and that told me how fast I was going through the air in miles per hour. But the one thing that we relied on was a Mach meter that told us what our percentage was in relationship to the speed of sound. For instance, Mach 1 is the speed of sound at the altitude you're flying. And if you're going 0.9 Mach, that's 90% of the speed of sound. Because, see, an airplane, responds to the effects of the speed of sound, like or shock waves on the airplane. So you're only interested in your percentage of the speed of sound or the Mach number that you're going. I had a Mach meter that went up to 1.0, and the day that I actually broke Mach 1, I sat there and watched that Mach meter build up, you know, since we'd been up to about 0.94 or 0.95 Mach number on the previous flight. And I watched it build up, and when it got up to about 0.96, and then the buffeting was quite heavy on the airplane, it was shaking pretty bad. But then at that point, the Mach meter went off the scale, and if I extrapolated, you know, it'd be about 1.06, but the Mach meter only went to 1.0. But when it did, all the buffeting smoothed out, which was an indication that we had, you know, supersonic flow over the whole airplane, meaning that it was flying at supersonic speeds. And when this happened, we made the first sonic boom there at Edwards, and that's about the way it happened.
Could you hear the sonic boom from the plane?
No, you're in the airplane, which is in a pressurized cockpit, and you've got a helmet on, an oxygen mask, and no, you're making the shockwave. It's on your airplane, and you don't hear a shockwave or sonic boom.
When you realize that you'd broken the speed of sound, that your mission was accomplished, did you stay up in the air a while and just have a good time and celebrate?
I didn't have... No, you can't stay up because, see, a rocket, you burn out all of your fuel. It only had to last 2.5 minutes, and then you're gliding down to make a dead stick landing on Rogers Dry Lake out there at Edwards or then Muroc Air Base. I was elated. I did a couple rolls, and when I got down, since I was pretty well beat up from a horseback riding accident a couple of days before, I was kind of bushed. And also, you're sitting in that cold airplane. You really get cold soaked, and it's good to get out into the warm sun. And, you know, and also their program was classified, so it's not exactly as the film The Right Stuff depicts it, but we knew it was classified, and just a couple, three of us had a little party that night. I mean, big party, if you want to call it that.
What were the reasons for classifying it? Why was it so top secret?
Because of what we found out. And the reason was, if you recall, once we got into the region of the speed of sound, we lost our elevator effectiveness. Now, Terry, this may get a little technical, but all airplanes, light airplanes, if you looked at them, they have a horizontal stabilizer or a tail, and on the trailing edge of that horizontal stabilizer and the elevators or flippers. And when you move the control stick back, that elevator goes up, and that's what controls the attitude of your airplane. It makes the nose go up or go down. And when we got into up to about 0.93 Mach number, or 93% of the speed of sound, we lost the effectiveness of that elevator on the X-1, and we couldn't control our airplane. But we had built a capability into the X-1 of moving the whole horizontal stabilizer or tailplane, and we found out that, lo and behold, we could control the X-1 through Mach 1 with that horizontal stabilizer. Now, it was interesting to me, when that happened, we found that out. Then, of course, we started building flying tails on our airplanes, that our combat airplanes that were built 3 or 4 years later. And it was amusing to me to find out that the British and the French and the Soviet Union didn't find out that little trick for 5 years. That was the reason it was classified, and mm-hmm. rightly so.
How else did breaking the sound barrier change aviation?
Well, it opened up space to us. Up until that time, you recall, we would never had had an airplane out beyond the speed of sound, and we didn't know what problems we would run into, and that flying tail that I mentioned is one of the secrets we found out that solved a lot of problems. We also developed higher thrust engines that could drive fighter aircraft or operational aircraft through the speed of sound. Once we got beyond the speed of sound, then there's no other barriers other than heat, and that opened up space for us.
Now, this is a very exciting time when you were flying these test missions. You had a few close calls, though, when you were flying the X-1 and the X-1A. There was one time, I think it was in the X-1A, which was the follow-up plane to the X-1, where you had gotten too high.
Well, fast, Terry. See, in those days, back in the late 40s, early 50s, we were a lot of milestones to be broken. And we were moving out in speed. We'd broken Mach 1 in 1947, and 1953 rolled up, and we were working up above Mach 2, and we were just trying to go faster and faster to open up the universe. And the X-1A, I only made 4 flights in it, but on that particular flight, I'm setting at some, you know, 80,000 feet, going 2.5 Mach number, or 2.5 times the speed of sound, around 1,600 miles an hour. And we found out during that flight, that the tail was not big enough on the X-1 to stabilize it, like the vertical stabilizer and the horizontal stabilizer didn't keep the airplane going straight ahead when we got out beyond 2.3 Mach number, and the airplane just swapped ends and went through some wild gyrations. And back in those days, we didn't have ejection seats, so and you were pretty well locked into the airplane and couldn't get out, so you have to ride it down. And, I was a little apprehensive about where I was going to hit in the high Sierras out there, but fortunately, I stayed with the airplane and had enough instinct to recover from an inverted spin and then pop it out of the normal spin and find Roger's Dry Lake and come back and land. And I tell you, it was a wild ride, but the way I look at it, you either do or you don't. And, you know, if you don't, you live happily ever after, so...
Well, you know, you describe what it's like to see the ground coming up at you at 1,000 feet per second. That's a pretty dramatic image. How do you react? I mean, how can you think clearly
under those
circumstances when you're just like seconds away from actually meeting the Earth?
That's you don't think, as I mentioned here a few minutes back in the broadcast, you really don't think about the outcome of anything. You concentrate on survival at the time, and you do everything you can to save your tail. And that's what I was doing, trying to fight the airplane to recover it from the spins, and my pressure suit was inflated. I was pretty well beat up because of high G loads and rattling around in the airplane, and no, I didn't pay any attention to the ground because, you know, it's nothing to do about hitting it anyway.
Now, you say that some pilots end up crashing because they take too long to decide whether to jump or land when the plane has gotten out of control.
Well, accidents... in aircraft, there's human error involved in accidents about 75% of the time. And this could be pilot error or maintenance error or design or something. Anyway, human element enters into it. And in the early days when we started flying jet aircraft and we put ejection seats in them, then when a pilot gets himself, he always tries to save an airplane. And that was one of the transitions when we first put ejection seats in our fighters. That gave us the capability of saving the pilot, but you lost the airplane. Now, one thing that a pilot hates to do is to leave an airplane because he tries to save it. And the way you save a crippled airplane is by dead-sticking it or a flame-out landing, meaning try to get the airplane on a road or an airplane when you haven't got any power. In order to do this, you have to be very good, number one, and number two, you've got to have a very good surface to land it on. And most pilots will try to get the airplane down on a runway, but since they don't have any power, they may screw up their pattern or miscalculate on their pattern. Then at the last minute see, well, I can't possibly get this airplane down safely. I'll eject, but by then they're too low for their egress equipment to work, or the parachute or the ejection seat. So you lose your pilot and your airplane. So we went through a period of time back in the 50s when we had to really discipline pilots. If you lose your engine on this airplane, you eject, period. And don't fool around with trying to get it down in a dead stick landing.
How many times did you have to eject?
I bailed out of three airplanes. I lost had a P-39 and while in training back in 43, it blew up on me. And I also got shot down in a Mustang, and I bailed out of that one. And then I ejected out of the NF-104, which had a rocket seat in it, and I had a pressure suit on. And that was in, I think, 63.
Now, you started off your flying career in the military you started as a truck mechanic, and mechanics is what led you into the military in the first place. How did you get from a mechanic to a flyer?
Well, like you're right, my dad trained me as a mechanic, and I worked on all of his machinery. And then when I enlisted in the Air Force in 1941, straight out of high school, and America was mobilizing, so that was the thing that guys did. I was working on aircraft, and I was a crew chief. I noticed pilots had a little more fun than us maintenance types did, and lo and behold, in fact, in the 1st of December 1941, before the war started, before we got in the war, there was a bulletin on the bulletin board. I noticed a paper up there said, hey, if you're 18 years of age and have a high school education, you can apply for pilot training. You won't be commissioned a second lieutenant, because you'll be made a sergeant pilot. And I looked at that, and I said, hey, I'm 18. I have a high school education. So I applied for it, took my physical, and they called me up in the summer of 42, and I started flying, and then I started enjoying it. And, you know, it's just right place to right time, Terry.
You trained a lot of men who became astronauts. Do you regret that you missed the period where you could have become an astronaut yourself and gone off into space?
Well, I didn't miss the period. Actually, I was prime for the space program, which started in 1959. The only problem was, in order to apply for the space program or the first Mercury astronauts, you had to have a degree. And I didn't. I had a high school education, so I wasn't qualified and I didn't apply. Had I been qualified, I probably would have applied. But I didn't because I wasn't. But I was perfectly happy with doing the research flying that I'd been doing in the X-1, the X-1A, and the other aircraft there at Edwards. Yeah, it'd be fun to fly an airplane like the shuttle. I wouldn't particularly care about riding in a capsule like the Mercury, Gemini, or the Apollo capsule back in the old days. But the shuttle, that's a different story. It'd be fun to fly. But on the other hand, it'd be a waste of money to train me.
No, why?
Well, I'm too old. You wouldn't get a lot of longevity out of me, see?
Chuck Yeager speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Coming up, America's first man in space, Alan Shepard. This is Fresh Air.